Internet Talk Radio, Flame of the Internet.
Of the week, and we're talking to Bernhard Stockmann, who is technical director of eBone, the European backbone. Welcome to Geek of the Week.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Why don't you tell us what eBone is?
Okay. eBone is a consortium of European network service providers that has seen the need to go together to deploy a common infrastructure for European internet services.
Are you the equivalent to the NSFNet backbone, but for Europe? Are you the transit network for Europe?
We are not the only one. Mm-hmm. We are one of them. There are more. So,
is there a need for multiple transit networks? Do you hit one market and they hit another market?
No. There's a need for more. There's a need for competition. eBone was formed as there at the time when it was formed. There was no commercial service available in Europe, so the R&D community saw the need for them to start off to do it themselves until there are commercial competitors available, and that is now slowly happening in Europe.
You say eBone is a consortium. What does that
yeah.
mean? Do people just throw in resources? Is there a corporation that runs it?
Nah. It's a... association based on the signed memorandum of understanding on what the eBone shall mean to the members. The whole thing was formed September. Well, the first proposals were drafted in September 91, and then it was announced for a meeting to that everyone that could had a network could participate. And that meeting, it was decided that the initial formation of the backbone should be based on voluntary contributions. So that means that whatever resource you had on international networking in Europe and that you were prepared to dedicate to this effort was gathered into the pot. And after going around the table and gathered what every of these first participants had, I was shouted down to sit down and think what I could do with all these pieces. So that's what I did, and up came the first version of the eBone. So this was a very informal way of creating an international backbone, you could say. Now when the thing has grown very much and is regarded as a rather big success, we are starting to look at a more formal way of cost sharing, and we can't just go around again and ask for another year of contributions, because that means that someone will pay more and someone less. We are now trying to look at fair shares and things like that. So there is a eBone 93 budget now based on a fair contribution scheme. So we have gathered everything we had, shared, take the cost and shared among the participants, and the cost is based on the connected bandwidth.
eBone also provides links to the United States.
Yes.
Has forming a consortium actually reduced the number of links to the U.S.? Is this a regional solution to networking?
It's a hard question, because you could also say what would have happened if you have not coordinated the links. How many still 64K links would you then have seen across the Atlantic? So my belief, well, as a matter of fact, in a one or two cases, U.S. links were actually cancelled due to the existence of the eBone links. But the major benefit is, of course, that a lot of networking organizations today does not have to order their own links, but can order links to the closest eBone border system and by that have the connection to the United States.
What type of work is eBone doing internally as far as coordinating routing and trying to make some sense of the network within Europe? Obviously, you have many different countries and many different networks.
Uh-huh.
Is it a tougher routing problem than we face in the United States?
We are trying to make it simpler. I mean, one of the statements in the Memorandum of Understanding for Ebon says that Ebon shall not have any restrictions on traffic. So we are not facing internally in Ebon an AUP problem. We can take on any kinds of traffic. Now, the policy, the routing policy, you could say, is in some sense the opposite of the NSFNet. In NSFNet, you have a policy, and you have to make the regionals adhere to that policy. In the Ebon backbone, we have taken out any kind of policy in the internal backbone, and the policy that regionals to Ebon may have has to be implemented in their connection to the Ebon. So if regionals have a policy, it's up to them to implement it. Ebon doesn't implement it.
Aren't you afraid that you'll be shattering a bunch of data into some poor regional that doesn't want it? It's up to them to provide that firewall. And
yeah, it is.
Is that, you think, a general solution to the questions of policy routing and security and other issues in the network, is leave it up to the endpoints? And all you are is a bit pump as a transit network?
Well, I'm not so sure if that is the case. I mean, if you are looking at the security, I think there was some statement from some source saying that security is not an issue for the transit networks, but for the end host. I mean, the security has to be applied at the host. If there is not sufficiently security management in a host, then it's very vulnerable to threats. And I think the same thing goes here. And if we are going to have all kinds of traffic being able to be forwarded by Ebon, then we cannot take on some kind of policy, routing policy restrictions. We have to be able to support all the members, and those are from the commercial, from the carriers, from the governments and things like that. We have to be able to support all that traffic.
Are you, in fact, do you support commercial traffic on the Ebon?
Sure, certainly. I mean, the intention here is, of course, to take the advantage of commercial traffic being able to use Ebon. I mean, this creates incomes for Ebon, and by that also is to see as a benefit for the R&D community. I mean, if you have a collaboration among, if you see collaboration among R&D networks as useful and good, why shouldn't that also be valid if you include commercial networks, if you cooperate on the broader level? So that is the intention. Yeah.
So Ebon is a central point where networks can connect. It's a transit network. It's AUP free. This sounds like a global internet exchange, or at least a European internet exchange.
It has been viewed, okay. Ebon has two roles today. It has a role of provision of, as you say, neutral global interconnectivity. It has also the role of providing backbone capacity to the European countries, especially, for example, to the Eastern and Central European countries where such connectivity is not being able to purchase today. So the roles may have to be separated in the future, but Ebon being some kind of distributed gigs is a true statement. Yes, it is.
Now, should other regions, such as Africa or the Middle East, come up with similar solutions, or should Ebon expand to service those areas? Do you go to Tunisia, for example, or Algeria? And would you?
There is, if you see today, there is a consortium of European network service provider who have created the backbone. And between them, there is an agreement that they today shall pay a fee that is based on the connected bandwidth. That is, however, not valid if you go outside of Europe, because then you have to see to the, for example, if you look at US to Ebon connections, you have to see to that the cost is rather significant, and that there are interest from, for example, from NSF, from AltNet or other US networking service providers to connect to Ebon. So the agreements, I don't know if this is formal or informal, but anyway, how it is done is that each party here pays its half circuit. So, for example, NSFNet pays the US half circuit to Ebon, and Ebon, as a consortium, pays its half circuit to the US. So the US, the intercontinental links are seen, at least with respect to the US connections, as a common resource, a common Ebon resource.
Should there be a regional solution then for, let's say, the Mideast or for Africa? Should those countries be learning a lesson from Ebone and trying to form a similar type of consortium?
Well, it's possible. I guess if they have that need, I'm not so sure if they have that need today, because the consortium in Europe was formed because of the multitude of uncoordinated links to try to coordinate them both internally in Europe and towards other continents. And I'm not sure if that is the case, for example, in the Middle East and in Africa. But it might be a useful way to start to do networking in these countries, to go together, of course, and share financially heavy resources.
What I'm interested in is, how do we scale this network up to be a truly global network? And do we do that with a single GIX based in Washington, D.C., or do we begin forming regional solutions around the world?
Okay, that has to be looked at a little bit more. I mean, we are trying to deploy a what we call a proto-GIX in Washington, D.C. today, to test the whole concept out. And if that is successful, okay. And also, if there is some kind of if you are deploying multiple GIX in the world, who is going to pay the interconnection bandwidth, and which are the rules for these things? And if these things are covered, if these kind of administrative issues are really covered, and if there's an agreement that this is a viable way to do, sure, it could be done. We are looking at that you have to have this kind of neutral interconnects in the world, so at some spots where all kinds of network service providers have the possibility to interconnect. And this is, of course, with the intention to keep the global internet connected, so that we don't see what some people see as a threat towards the internet, and that is the fragmentation, the balkanization of the internet.
Some people say that a global ATM cloud will solve all these problems, and it'll provide a virtual worldwide GIX, and it'll in fact do away with the need for routers altogether, because you are only one hop away from any neighbor. Do you see that as a trend?
No, I don't think so. ATM could be used to deliver regional services, but there's a need to multiplex on a lower layer, where there's sufficient capacity to do that. But if you're going to the intercontinental lines as we see them today, they are fully loaded, mostly. And to put another layer of multiplexing on top of that will not increase the utilization efficiency. So I don't think that is, I don't believe it's a good thing today anyway.
So you think pushing the problems down to the data linker is not necessarily a solution?
Excuse me?
Pushing problems down to the data link, saying, well, we don't need to deal with these problems at Ebone because ATM is going to take care of them for us.
I don't think that's the way. No.
No. Ebone has been very active in using BGP as an internal routing protocol, in deploying CIDR and other solutions. Can you give us some insight as to whether these solutions such as CIDR appear to be dealing with the problems of routing table explosion and address depletion? Are these feasible solutions to those problems?
Yeah, I mean, this has been discussed at length in ITF, and I believe for the coming 2-3 years, CIDR will be a reasonable method of dealing with these problems. And we will of course in Ebone deploy CIDR and BGP4 as well, and we will be part of what is known now as the CIDR core, together with some of the U.S. Federal backbones and other backbones in the United States.
Well, explain what that CIDR core is and what the purpose is.
Okay, I've not been part of this meeting myself. I just very briefly read the minutes. I don't know very much about it. But obviously, defined here, the CIDR core will be the initial top-level transit backbones that will go to the CIDR BGP4 at a very early stage, so that later on, regionals behind them can also either default route or turn to CIDR, whatever they like. But there has to be a top-level BGP4 implementation in advance of anything else below.
So assuming many addresses in Europe fall within a certain prefix, that allows Ebone to advertise simply that prefix to the rest of the world and say anything that starts with 1925 is ours.
Yeah. Well, in principle, yes. In principle, yes.
Now, is that going to work, or are we going to end up with so many exceptions and so much fragmentation that it doesn't solve the problem?
Okay. There is always an entropy into this, and there is an assumption that the internet network will be that stable, at least, that the entropy will not destroy the benefits of CIDR within 2-3 years framework. So that is what the whole concept is based on.
Is it based on an assumption that our growth rate will not increase substantially? Is that one of the fundamental assumptions?
No, not just the growth rate, but also, I mean, the CIDR is based on aggregation. And aggregation, in turn, is based on that the all the networks within a certain aggregation area remains within that aggregation area. But of course, networks can move geographically and come to or change service providers or whatever, and that of course destroys the benefits and the possibility of doing aggregation for just that network. But the assumption is then that the such tendencies will not destroy the overall benefits within 2-3 years of time frames. That is far as I know.
Of efforts around the world to coordinate different network activities. There's been the CERN for the intercontinental what's a committee on intercontinental research networking. There's been the International Engineering Planning Group, the IEPG. There's an operations directorate within the IETF. Are any of these bodies successfully able to coordinate the activities of networks, and do we even need such a coordination function?
Interesting question. Yeah. Yes, there is a need for coordination of networking activities because some of the concepts in internet managed from a single service provider, but has to be managed over the boundaries of service provider. For example, DNS. For example, address registration. For example, routing policy registration and things like that cross the borders of service providers.
And these are not just standards making activities. These are actually operational coordination functions.
The standards here is, of course, for example, BGP4 standard for routing, DNS standard for DNS services and things like that, that are actually being deployed. That is the standardization. Then you have operational requirements on standards. That is foreseen some kind of operational needs in some kind of standards that has to be looked at. Then at the deployment level, you have the coordination of actually deployed software, actually deployed services. And today, I don't think there are some kind of efforts to create such coordination bodies, but no one seems to be really globally accepted today. So we still have a variety of efforts which resembles such coordination, for example, in the IEPG, for example, in the operations requirements area in the IETF, for example, in the RIPE organization in Europe. You always see, I mean, if you come to the IETF, you could as well have an operational coordinations meeting. For it's the same kind of people. It's as being said, the usual victims always turns up. And I mean, it's just a matter of framework, in which framework you are meeting. So one possible thing would be, for example, now to invite already existing service providers in the networking arena and present coming network service providers like the carriers to have a discussion on what kind of coordination body there is a need for, if it exists, and if not, who is going to create it, how it's going to be created, and things like that. If you, for example, compare to the switch voice, you have such coordination bodies, at least in Europe, I believe, it's something called ETNO, European Telecommunication Network Operators Association, something like that, where there are such coordination among carriers. So, I mean, the question here is, where is the, such an initiative? Where should it come from? Should it come from the internet technical people like me? Should it come from the service providers, from the carriers? Well, I don't think it's a big issue where it comes from, but it has to come from somewhere anyway. So why not from us?
Well, the IETF has always been viewed as a very informal American-centric body, and I've heard many people argue that in order for the internet and the IETF and others to be taken seriously, there needs to be some form of international accreditation. Do you think the IETF should be located in Geneva with a headquarters building, and should that be a internet society relocate to next to the ITU?
Wouldn't that be unfair to the U.S. people to have it in Switzerland, and wouldn't it be unfair to the Swiss people to have it in the United States? Maybe we should locate it on the moon or something. I don't know. No, seriously. Today, the internet, the network, I think around 70%, something like that, is within the United States. So, I mean, I don't have a problem with this personally. It might be that others have it, but I think it's a rather good idea now to see that of three IETF meetings, probably one will happen out of the United States.
Well, the Internet Society is a global organization. Right now, the IETF is based on face-to-face meetings three times a year.
Uh-huh.
Is it realistic to think that 700 to 1,000 to 2,000 people are going to be able to fly around the world? And it doesn't matter where you are, a substantial population has to fly in. Are there other ways to do this standards-making process that we do?
I have no idea. I mean, yeah, sure, there is, of course, a lot of other ways to look at. I don't know how ISO works, but I assume that the complete set of ISO representatives does not meet at once, but they have some kind of sub-meetings, separate meetings, and...
ISO is very proud to state that on any given day there are 9 meetings around the world.
Okay. I don't know if that's something to be proud of. I don't know. Depends maybe on the output. Sure. I mean, IETF is growing rather big, and I mean, for example, we can't meet at any kind of place today. We have to have special big hotels and things like that to be able to host such big meetings. And if this tendency grows and gets even bigger, of course, then comes again the question of, shall we split up, and shall we have, for example, meetings within separate meetings between areas or interest groups or whatever. That's a possible way of dealing with these problems, yes.
Well, you're on the Internet Engineering Steering Group, uh-huh. The governing body. Do you find you're able to participate effectively in that body, or are you continually getting on a plane or staying on the phone at 3 in the morning?
Am I a doer or am I a goer? Well, unfortunately, I must not characterize myself as a goer. I'm traveling a lot and trying to organize meetings and things like that. And, of course, I cannot put in the amount of work I think the operations area deserves today. That's true. So my, well, the area directorship deserves quite a lot of time if it should be managed in a good way, and I don't think I have the time. That's true.
Should it be a full-time job? Should you take a leave of absence for a year and enter community service, sort of like the Army?
Interesting idea. Why not? Why not? Community service, serving the standards organization, whoever. Why not? No, okay, if not full-time, at least something like 25-30% of a full-time is at least needed to be able to do the AD work. And for that reason, you must have the support from your employer. You have to have time able to set aside for this work. Otherwise, you can't do it on weekends and evenings. It's not possible to do it. So, well, that's the problem with the IESG and being a voluntary organization. So,
is it gonna be able to continue based on voluntary labor? Is it just getting too big to handle?
I mean, it's not voluntary in a sense today. I mean, those people who are asked to go to the IESG, I assume, go back to their home organization and ask for permission to set aside 1, 2, 3 days a week. If they don't do that, they are in a problem. They have a problem. So in that sense, it's not voluntarily.
It's voluntary in the sense that you ask to serve, but then once you're there, you got a job.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay, there is no one centrally paying you, so in some sense your home organization is of course funding this, but it's better if they are aware of it.
Oh, it certainly helps, otherwise they might wonder why you're never in the office, huh?
Exactly, exactly. Or you're doing a bad job, because not giving this the time it deserves.
But ultimately, do you find that your work with the IESG and the IEPG are beneficial to your employer?
Oh, sure it is. Certainly it is.
What do they get out of it?
I mean, they get out of it a lot of, first of all, knowledge of the standards-making process as such. And in Europe, that is recently becoming more and more known. Right? I mean, for a couple of years ago, ITF was not that known in Europe. It was known in some small sub-communities of the networking people, but now today, because of more and more involvement from European people, it's starting to get very well known in Europe. And of course, one issue is then the Amsterdam meeting that will actually show that there are an ITF in Europe as well. And that is one thing. Now, the second thing is then that European organization, by seeing the ITF as a standards-making body, also have the possibility, once they know that it exists and it functions, to influence the standards, and by that influence their own home environment in the networking scene.
Well, thank you very much. This has been Geek of the Week. We've been talking to Bernhard Stockmann, Technical Director of EBONE, the European Backbone.
This is Internet Talk Radio, Flame of the Internet. You've been listening to Geek of the Week. You may copy this program to any medium and change the encoding, but may not alter the data or sell the contents. To purchase an audio cassette of this program, send mail to radio@ora.com. Support for Geek of the Week comes from Sun Microsystems. Sun, the network is the computer. Support for Geek of the Week also comes from O'Reilly & Associates, publishers of The Global Network Navigator, your online hypertext magazine. For more information, send mail to info@gnn.com. Network connectivity for the Internet Multicasting Service is provided by MFS DataNet and by UUNet Technologies. Executive producer for Geek of the Week is Martin Lucas. Production manager is James Rowland. Rick Dunbar and Curtis Jenris are the sysadmins. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service, Town Crier to the Global Village.